year ago, over 200,000 people descended on Edinburgh in Scotland as the Make Poverty History campaign reached a climax ahead of the G8 meeting of world leaders in nearby Gleneagles. In other cities across the world, billions of people either attended or watched the mega Live 8 concerts, also aimed at focusing world attention on the need to provide debt relief, more aid and better trade agreements for people in the world's poorest nations. So 1 year on, what exactly did that campaign achieve? Have pledges made at the summit translated into improved living conditions for people struggling daily against the vicious cycles of poverty, sickness and despair? In short, did the mass mobilisation succeed in persuading G8 leaders to make poverty history?
I think it certainly impressed them.
George Gelber is head of policy with CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development.
And it certainly enabled the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to point to the groundswell of public opinion, because there's no doubt that he was the person pressing the aid package on his fellow G8 leaders.
But in terms of the actual promises that they were able to come up with, you mentioned aid, of course, the other two areas, debt relief and trade. Just if you like, give us a view a year on from how much those promises really have meant a difference to people on the ground in the countries where you're working.
Let's start with debt relief. Debt relief, in fact, was negotiated by the finance ministers and was signed off at the end of the year by the IMF and 3 months later at its spring meetings by the World Bank. And that means that developing countries are already benefiting because they are not having to pay their debt service to the multilateral institutions. And this money is going into investments that benefit the poor, principally education and health. And we know that in Zambia they've taken on more teachers and more health personnel. Other countries have also benefited. Aid is more problematic. The G8 leaders promised to raise the level of global aid by an additional $50 billion a year by 2010. And $20 billion is new money. Now, this compares with debt relief, which is worth $1 billion a year, mainly to African countries, and another $1 billion a year to Nigeria alone. So you can see that aid is worth a lot more in terms of the actual resource transfer than debt relief. And, of course, pledges that are made in July, in 1 year, take some time to begin to work their way through the system, so that it is, I think, unrealistic to expect that the full amount of aid will be delivered. But it's very important that countries put themselves on a trajectory that will enable them to deliver the full additional $50 billion in 2010. If they backload it, if they delay raising aid up till 2008 and 2009, then the leap that they will have to make in 2010 will be simply too great, and they will fail to do that.
Is it not true in some cases, though, that governments are proposing taking money from their aid budget and using it on debt relief? In other words, confusing the statistics to make it look as though more money is actually going out to help these developing countries?
Well, I don't think it's a deliberate attempt to confuse people. Debt relief is counted as aid, and the huge debt relief deals agreed for Iraq and for Nigeria have certainly inflated aid budgets this year, and it's disingenuous if governments are claiming that this is a huge increase in aid. And, of course, it will boomerang on them, because now that this debt relief for Nigeria and Iraq is out of the way, their aid budgets will actually appear to fall next year, when, of course, they should be rising. But I think debt relief has to be accounted for, and certainly Make Poverty History have said all along that it should be accounted for separately.
You mentioned the case of Zambia, which is perhaps one of the strongest examples of success where money has gone into education, into healthcare. There are other countries where there are many concerns about the way that the governments, the African governments, have used the money to finance either conflicts or money has been lost through corruption. What's your view on that?
This is a huge, huge problem with which we are beginning to get to grips. NGOs who've been clamoring for more aid and more debt relief have in the past been reluctant to deal with the issue of corruption because we didn't want to undermine public support for more aid and debt relief by pointing to the problems. But of course, now we have to look at how all these additional resources are actually going to deliver benefits for poor people. And corruption is one of the issues that we're discussing. Now, the countries that are receiving debt relief have been given a good enough bill of health by donors, by the World Bank. They're recognized as reasonably honest, reasonably competent, and committed to poverty reduction. There are large numbers of other countries which our own Department for International Development calls fragile states, where you can't say the same thing. And these fragile states stand outside the debt relief agreements and aid agreements, and donors have to have a much more careful eye on the aid that they provide. They have to audit the programs, have tightly controlled programs, and so on. This isn't ideal, but this is the way that they're tackling it. And of course, simply to give the money open-handedly to governments which do not satisfy basic criteria of honesty or competence would be to waste it and would be to lose the trust of our own taxpayers who are the ultimate providers of this assistance.
You're talking about corruption then as one of the biggest challenges perhaps facing this whole Make Poverty History campaign. What, in your view, are the strongest guarantees? What are the best ways in which people can pressure these governments to really deliver the money that is coming through to them?
I don't think there's any silver bullet that can guarantee that aid money is spent well. I think that it's a long-term process, and for us NGOs, we have a crucial role to play in building up, helping to build up civil society in those countries so that it's civil society that holds their governments to account, because ultimately it is the citizens of a country who have to hold their government to account, along with their institutions like parliament and the courts. But this is long-term, and it certainly isn't easy. And in some countries, perhaps recently emerging from conflict, you find that civil society, NGOs, even the church can be somewhat cowed by authoritarian governments.
The churches have played an important role, haven't they, in this whole Make Poverty History campaign, both here in the West and also in the countries that are the recipients of a lot of this money?
Indeed, they have. And I think that the churches do speak with a degree of authority. And also, church leaders perhaps have greater freedom to express themselves than an ordinary layperson. You know, an archbishop is an impressive figure, and governments are much more reluctant to stamp down on an archbishop than they would be, say, on just an ordinary NGO campaigner. So there's a certain amount of what the Latin Americans would call fuero, or freedom for the church to speak out. And of course, we're very glad that church leaders from around the world have really lent their support to Make Poverty History.
Looking ahead now to the St. Petersburg summit, what would be your message then to anybody who wants to stay involved with this campaign to try and see more progress on this issue?
I think we have to stay engaged. Priorities for the Russians at St. Petersburg are going to be energy and security, which are obviously relevant, but not directly relevant to the concerns of Make Poverty History. Our goal now is to look forward to the G8 in Germany next year, when 2 years after Gleneagles, when we really should be able to see whether the governments are delivering on the promises that they made at Gleneagles. And of course, we looking back, we remember that the huge demonstration in favor of debt cancellation organized by Jubilee 2000 at the 1998 G8 held in Birmingham in England, which was followed by the G8 leaders agreeing to the heavily indebted poor country initiative on debt, which was the first time that the door was opened to debt relief for developing countries. So we're looking from Gleneagles in the UK last year, 2005, towards the German G8 in 2007.
My thanks there to George Gelber of CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development.